You're listening to I'm Ready for My Close-Up on Resonance 104.4 FM. On today's show, myself, Alex Fitch, and Virginie Selavy will be talking about Sci-Fi London, London's premier science fiction, fantasy, and cult entertainment festival. Our guest, festival organiser and programmer Louis Savvy, is hopefully en route, but in the meantime, we're going to talk about films that I've seen at Sci-Fi London in the past and what we're expecting from this year's festival. Virginie, you're looking forward to Dante 01, I believe, at this year's festival.
I am, yes, definitely. I think it's an interesting choice for their opening night. It seems that they have quite high-profile films for both their opening and closing nights, because they've got Chemical Wedding as well, which was written by Bruce Dickinson of Iron Maiden fame. So it seems that they've been able to attract bigger and bigger films over the year.
Definitely. I mean, in terms of the guests that they have coming along, they've got Simon Callow coming to the premiere of Chemical Wedding, along with other members of the cast and crew. And in previous years, they had a premiere of one of Ken Russell's new films, and he attended the screening. And Stuart Gordon came last year, director of Reanimated, to talk about Edmund. But then last year, the festival was also combined with Cine Access, which is a separate event this year, and I believe you spoke to Xavier Mendick about it last week.
Yes, that was last week's programme. We spoke to Xavier, so they said that they wanted to keep it going on that same weekend so that it's still linked to Sci-Fi London, but it's separate and run independently, just so because they felt the festival had grown enough for that to happen.
well,
it'll be difficult to cope with everything that weekend and to manage to go and see everything, because it's going to be a lot of films over the weekend.
Well, yes, I mean, and I believe that you are hoping to see some Japanese animation at the Barbican as
yes,
well.
Yes, I think I might have to give up on that.
It's funny as well, because before Sci-Fi London moved to Apollo West End, it used to be at the Metro Cinema near the Trocadero and at the Curzon Soho, so that there would always be people walking up and down Shaftesbury Avenue saying, oh, what film are you going to see? Oh, I'm going to see this one. Which film are you going to see? And in a way, it'll be like that again if people are going back and forth between Cine Access at the ICA and Sci-Fi London.
Do you think that will happen?
Well, I'd like to think so. I mean, you know, obviously all the films they're showing at Sci-Fi London are entertaining enough that people may not need to go to the ICA, but as we're supporting both the show that you advertised last week and the event that I'm advertising this week, we don't want to step on anyone's toes.
How much of a crossover do you think there is between the two kind of audiences that they're attracting?
I asked Louis that very question last year, and I imagine if he was here, he'd say that he's aware that some of the films that he shows and some of the films they show at Cine Access have very different audiences. Some are sort of like more po-faced cult films, like Edmund, for example, which Cine Access showed last year, isn't the sort of film they could really show at Sci-Fi London, because there isn't any actual sci-fi or fantasy elements in it, even though it's by a genre director. And so the sort of person who goes to see that probably wouldn't be the same person who, say, last year at Sci-Fi London would have gone to see Captain Eager and the Mark of Voth. Less said about that, the better. But some of the films they're showing at Sci-Fi, I mean, he said last year that for example, there's a film called CSA, which was a mockumentary about an alternate America where the South won the Civil War, you know, a couple hundred years ago. And so America was even more sort of polarized than it is now. And the distributors didn't even want him to show the film because they're saying it's not sci-fi. And you're like, well, of course it's sci-fi. It's about a parallel universe. It's speculative fiction, which is, I think, one of the reasons a lot of people prefer the term SF to sci-fi, because it covers, you know, more ground.
Yeah, and the thing that people forget about this festival is that it's the whole title, and I guess it's because it's so long that people forget about this, is the London International Festival of Science Fiction and Fantastic Film, which I think is an important element that shouldn't be forgotten. I mean, for me, that's the most interesting aspect, maybe, because then you have a wider variety of films, not just things that fit into a specific genre.
Mm. Well, I mean, my favourite film from last year was Mihiko Takashi's film Yokai Wars, which was a brilliant kids' fantasy film. I think it's one of the best kids' fantasy films I've seen since there was a run of them in the early 80s, things like Time Bandits and Labyrinth and The Dark Crystal. And we've not seen their like for years. There have been fantasy science fiction films for kids over the past few years, they all seem to be a bit rubbish, to be honest, and they're all based on book franchises. Well, that seemed to hark back to a more primitive time where people wore costumes, you had animated puppets as characters, and those just seemed a lot more inventive. And it seems that Sci-Fi London, it's great that it exists because it provides a venue for seeing those sort of films that then don't get a wider release, which I think is crazy, looking at some of the rubbish that does turn up in mainstream cinemas, that if you want to see alternative sci-fi and fancy programming and want to see it on the big screen, instead of tracking down a Region 1 DVD from Amazon, you can actually see it over this weekend.
Yeah, definitely. One of the films that they showed, I believe, and that I thought was really interesting and fits more into the fantastic part of the festival rather than science fiction, is a film called Primer, which I think you didn't like so much. But I thought that was a great film. It was very inventive. I thought that was the kind of film that I would like to see at the festival, which is less obviously sci-fi, but is more cerebral, I guess. But with a very limited budget, very limited resources, is very inventive. And I guess a festival like this provides a kind of space where you can see films like that, because it didn't have a massive release. I mean, it was released in the UK, which is something, but I'm not sure many people are aware of that film. And there's a film in this year's programme called Suspension, which sounds like it might be the same
kind
of thing.
This year's underground American indie hit.
Yes, okay. Cerebral underground sci-fi hit. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that one.
What is that film about?
About time travelling. Yeah, that kind of stuff. Yeah, okay. I can't quite remember what it said, I must admit. I was hoping Louis might be able to tell us more about it. But yeah, no, it sounds like an intelligent kind of fantasy tale about time travelling.
I'm a big fan of time travel, I must admit.
Yes.
I mean, that's the thing, because Primer, for all its sort of Sundance-winning trappings, I think didn't quite work as a sci-fi film for me, because it came up with a great idea that you could only travel backwards in time at the same speed as you'd be travelling forwards in time, which obviously limits your ability to time travel, because you have to put yourself in a sealed box and put on an oxygen tank and that. And I loved all that idea, but it just didn't make sense. It felt like there were entire scenes missing. I don't know if it was because they ran out of budget and it was just a rush to get to the end of the film so that they could show it at Sundance or something. But I mean, a film like that, I think, deserves to be highly commended just for its inventiveness and the fact that there aren't other cerebral, like you say, films in the marketplace competing for that kind of audience. I mean, a film that we've both seen that's showing at this year's Sci-Fi London is La Antena, which is a brilliant Argentinian silent movie that we're going to be discussing in more depth in a couple of weeks' time when it gets a wider release in the cinema, and I'm glad that it is getting a wider release in the cinema. But it's interesting that a film like that, which again, is more fantastical than sci-fi. It exists in a sort of a fantasy world that looks like something from an etching in a Grimm's Brother Grimm even, fairy tale, rather than the sort of thing that you would see produced by Peter Jackson or Sam Raimi or whoever.
Yeah, that is a really, really interesting one, because it doesn't have any easy special effects or anything to kind of draw you in the kind of facile genre way. It doesn't have zombies, doesn't have, you know, spaceships or anything. So, I mean, it is science fiction and it is fantastic, but in that, let's say, maybe less literal kind of way. And yeah, I mean, that's definitely an amazing film. Definitely want to see. Yeah.
I mean, another film they're showing that I'm looking forward to is the one that we mentioned earlier that you're going to see, Dante 01, because it's Mark Caro's directorial debut. And as the co-directing partner of Jean-Pierre Jeunet, he, of course, co-directed City of Lost Children and Delicatessen. And then Jeunet went it alone to make the less than successful Alien Resurrection and the not too bad Amelie. And it's a shame that Caro has taken so long to come to the big screen by himself. Maybe it's because he's more of a visual stylist than, say, an actor's director. But I'm interested to see what his film's going to be like.
Well, me too, definitely, because I think Jeunet's career since Delicatessen, City of Lost Children, has been quite disappointing for me anyway. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Amelie. I think it's far too saccharine, and I don't like that kind of twee fantasy world, really. And I think maybe, you know, that means that Carol was responsible for the less twee aspect, the more, you know, the darker side of Delicatessen and City of Lost Children. So I'm definitely looking forward to Dante 01. And one thing you mentioned in the feature you wrote about it was the kind of genre of prison films, which I thought was interesting, that it was part of that.
Yeah, I mean, and also, I mean, thinking of Jeunet and Kara's films, they had like a third silent partner, as it was, Pitoff, who did the special effects on their films and is also a comic book artist in France. And he did, he's directed his first film in French, which is called Vidocq. And it's a sort of, it's a surrealist, sort of Borghesian murder mystery with Gérard Depardieu. And that was visually stunning. I mean, it looked like sort of turn-of-the-century paintings come to life, like, you know, moving oil paintings. And that's the sort of thing that I'm hoping from Dante 01.
The images look promising, I think. So.
Although it's got a middling score on the IMDb, but it...
Okay.
who cares what
yes,
they
exactly,
think?
Yes, yeah.
Also, in this year's Sci-Fi London, as in previous years, they've got the Arthur C. Clarke Awards. And I think that's showing that SFL want to have a literary content to broaden their remit beyond just sitting down and watching films in a cinema. And I believe that all of the Arthur C. Clarke nominees this year, well, obviously they'll be in attendance because the winner's going to be announced at this year's festival. So we'll see the likes of Stephen Baxter and Ken MacLeod attending. And I think the fact that the Arthur C. Clarke Awards have been integrated into SFL show the kind of respect, I suppose, that the festival has been given within the sort of the sci-fi world, as it were.
Yeah, one other thing that they're doing, which I thought was quite interesting, is the Sci-Fi Film School, where aspiring sci-fi filmmakers can learn from film professionals about things like script writing and makeup and sound for £20, which I thought was rather good value. And this, they explain in the programme that they're doing because they want more sci-fi films to be made. And I really wanted to ask Louis what he thought about, you know, the state of sci-fi filmmaking in Britain, what kind of sci-fi films he would like to see more of. So I guess we'll have to wait for the answer to that question. But I thought it was interesting that they used the festival as a way of promoting the making of sci-fi films in Britain.
Mm. Well, I mean, they always show, with all the features they show at SFL, they have a short made by a low-budget filmmaker accompanying every feature, and then they have programmes where you can just sit down and watch all the shorts together. And because the number of people who submit short films to Sci-Fi London has increased exponentially every year, there's now an additional Sci-Fi London website, scifilondon.tv, where you can see not only the award-winning films from previous years, but films that didn't quite make the cut in terms of the shortlist for the festival itself. I think they can only show, you know, a maximum of 20 films, 20 short films. But if there are 50 that Louis liked, he's put the other 30 online. So it gives people a chance to see the kind of sci-fi short films that are being made and then, you know, encourages other people to do the same.
That's a really interesting link, I think, between the festival and the website. The fact that it's not just something that happens once a year, but that there's this ongoing presence on the internet. I think that's really interesting because it does allow them to do things like that and to promote it at that level. So yeah, I think that's a major difference from other festivals.
Mm. Well, that's the thing, because, I mean, if you go to the regular London Film Festival, they do show short films, but they're ones that have almost been ratified already by winning other festivals, even though, allegedly, the LFF has a remit that they want to show films as premieres, but that obviously isn't the case, because these have been chosen from a short list. While Sci-Fi London has an award for Best Short Film every year, so by submitting your film to the festival, you're sort of entering a competition with your peers and hoping to win. And then not only being chosen but winning at SFL will obviously give your film a pedigree and hopefully get it wider distribution.
Yeah, and they do this 48-hour film challenge. Mm. in which they give you a title, dialogue, some props, and off you go. You make a film in 48 hours. And if it's in good, you it gets screened at the closing night.
Excellent.
Which is quite an amazing thing. I mean, imagine, you know, you just make a short film in 2 days and then it ends up being screened before Chemical Wedding, which I'm sure will attract a very large audience. So I think that's, again, another fantastic thing they do to promote sci-fi filmmaking.
Mm. Well, I actually entered one of those 48-hour filmmaking competitions a few years ago. It was organised by the Ritzy. And you turned up on, say, the Friday evening. And I don't think you were given a title because that would have been, you know, almost too much of a challenge. But they gave you like a shopping list of, say, 20 items, like a black cab, a red taxi, the London Eye, and you had to choose three and put them in your film so that, therefore, when you made your film in the next 24 hours, they knew that you were making it there and then. You hadn't made it in advance and were just bringing it with you. I mean, I suppose you could splice them in and hope that it wasn't that obvious. But the kind of films, when I entered that competition, that were made in those 48 hours, there was a wide breadth of genres. Someone had made like a puppet's guide to a Brixton market and turned it into a pop video. Other people had made thrillers. Myself and some friends made a ghost story. So I think one of the ways of encouraging creativity is to give a person certain limitations and then ask them to work within those. Because if you give someone a completely blank sheet, it can be absolutely intimidating. But if you know you've got a certain thing to fulfill or a certain idea that you have to include, in a way, it gives you a way in and helps facilitate the film.
Yeah, no, definitely. and they do all-nighters as well.
Yes, the famous
yes.
all-nighters.
Yeah, which, as you said in your feature, are now being copied by everyone. And it's true that they've become increasingly popular. Mm. And the Curzon cinemas are now doing those midnight movie nights, which are not all-nighters, but, you know, they do finish at 2 or 3 in the morning.
And the BFI IMAX as well, they do them as well.
Yeah, so that's an interesting phenomenon. So what's the fun, according to you, of watching films for the whole night?
I suppose it's just kind of indulging in a very escapist activity. That I've spoken to friends before when I told them that I've been to horror festivals, I've been to sci-fi festivals, and I've seen 3 or 4 films in a row, and they're like, "You saw 3 films in a row? We can barely watch 2." And I'm like, well, you know, you get into the rhythm of watching films. And I think, at the risk of sort of approaching a stereotype, the kind of people who go to horror and sci-fi festivals are perhaps a little bit more relaxed about their sleep patterns. And so the all-nighters, because they're a mixture of old films that don't get projected very often and they're a mixture of new films that you might have to see separately on other days at the festival, it's a good way of condensing your interests into one night. There's another resonance engineer who I hoped was going to be in the studio today, but he can't make it either. Robin Warren from the band Liberation Jumpsuit is looking forward to the Mystery Science Theatre 3000 all-nighter, which, for our listeners, if you haven't heard of it, is an American TV show where they get old B-movies, the worse the better, and then a bunch of comedians are superimposed in front of the film and they make sort of sarcastic comments as the film progresses, which makes it a more enjoyable experience. And the films that they're showing this year as the MST 3K all-nighter are Merlin's Mystical Shop of Wonders, The Creeping Terror, and Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, which I believe is a classic of the genre. The people who do MST 3K have actually, they wound up the program a few years ago, but they're now doing downloadable commentaries for films, and the first one of those they've done is for the diabolical Battlefield Earth, and so that's going to be showing at the all-nighter as well with their soundtrack. I know Louis wanted to get a 35mm print of the film. I don't think he was able to. I guess it's a kind of a hard thing to do, to go to Warner Brothers and say, "We want to show your film in a really good print, but we're going to take the mickey of it as it's being shown."
Yeah, definitely. There's also Dead Space All-Nighter, where they're showing space films like Alien, Solaris, Pitch Black and The Thing, which sounds like a night of very solid space classics, really.
Well, and sci-fi stroke horror crossover classics.
Yeah, yeah. So this should be a good night, I think. And the Anime All-Nighter, which includes Appleseed, Ex Machina, Vexil, the girl who leapt through time, and Tekken King Crete, which sounds interesting as well.
Yeah, defo. I mean, I've been wanting to see Tekken King Crete because I've read the manga Black and White, and it's a really kind of textually fantastic film about two kids, manga about two kids with superpowers who wander around this sort of desolate city that's teeming with rubbish and all the detritus of modern civilization. And the manga is just so sort of full of Dutch angles and weird drawings and colourful situations. It's going to be interesting to see how they pack it into a film and still keep some kind of narrative comprehensibility.
Yeah.
The other anime films they're showing, I'm not a big fan of Vexil, actually. I saw a preview of it a couple of months ago, and it did seem very derivative of big-budget sci-fi live-action films. But I guess the thing is, if anime is to become more approachable to a wider audience, you need to kind of tap into ideas that are in the zeitgeist so that they're familiar to sci-fi audiences if they're not used to seeing a big-budget sci-fi film that is just in animation.
Yeah, I guess things are kind of evolving, so we should probably be a bit patient with films like that. I felt like that when I watched the film called Sky Blue in English, a Korean animation, which again was disappointing in many respects, but you felt they were going somewhere and it was part of a whole process of working your way through how to use CGI, how to integrate all those new techniques and the storyline wasn't that interesting, and it felt very derivative, definitely, but you kind of felt some sympathy towards them because you could feel that it was part of this transition, this work towards something else, some other forms of animation. So I guess I think this kind of thing needs to be encouraged because that's how then your fantastic work emerges, which really surprises you, I think, based on all those other films that try things that maybe don't quite work.
Well, I mean, I didn't even know that there was a Korean animation industry until I saw Sky Blue. And it's probably more than possible that a lot of the anime cartoons that we saw as kids were outsourced to animation studios in China and Korea. But in terms of animation that has a distinct Korean identity as opposed to Japanese, I'd like to think that Sky Blue is the tip of the iceberg, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, it was definitely the biggest budget one, so I guess that's why we saw that one, and maybe we haven't seen any of the possibly more interesting ones that didn't make it to the UK. So, yeah, we'll have to see, but it's definitely an interesting development, I think.
And another anime they're showing at SFL this year is Appleseed Ex Machina, which you mentioned, which is the third of the Appleseed movies that previously has been a manga. It's previously been a TV series, and I think this is 3D CGI. And according to the American DVD release, although I can find no evidence of this on the IMDb, John Woo is one of the executive producers on the film. So again, a bit like Vexil, they're trying to get anime as a genre that perhaps people who normally only watch live-action sci-fi films will come and see as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. We'll see if that works.
In terms of the Dead Space all-nighter, I must admit I've not seen the remake of Solaris, but the fact that they've included it in a quadruple bill that includes Alien, Pitch Black and The Thing that are all sci-fi horror films, is the remake of Solaris more a horror film than the original?
Not really.
Okay.
It's an interesting choice. It's a very interesting choice because it's...
I mean, I suppose it's technically a ghost story. Or not even that.
Technically, but it really doesn't scare you.
Okay.
It's
not
really...
Not even Clooney in space.
No. No, it's a very... I mean, it's more a love story than a space story or a horror story, really. So it is an interesting choice because it's a more... it's a much less genre film than any of the others. But then Pitch Black is an interesting inclusion as well because that's you know, Alien and The Thing are definitely kind of, you know, cult films of that genre, totally classics that everyone will have known, will have seen if they're interested in that kind of film. But Pitch Black is a more recent film, so that's probably more obscure for some people. I mean, everyone has, you know, heard of Alien and The Thing, but maybe not Pitch Black.
Even with the bloated sequel that they brought out.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's true. Yeah, I haven't seen the sequel. Yeah, I enjoyed Pitch Black.
Me too.
It's fun. It's very straightforward in what it does, but it is very enjoyable. And it's interesting that there's such a contrast between Pitch Black and Solaris, because Solaris is kind of completely at the opposite end of the spectrum, basically. Mm. It's much more about emotions and about grief process, really. So it's kind of bizarre that, you know, both films are included in that selection. But I think it makes it a very interesting selection for that reason.
Well, in a way, I mean, it sort of exemplifies what Sci-Fi London's all about. That sort of quadruple bill is showing the kind of films that you might see in sci-fi, but in microcosm. A romantic sci-fi story that's a remake of a Russian film, a couple of classics from the early 80s, and a big budget film from recent years that perhaps didn't get the attention that it originally did. I mean, in terms of other classic movies that they're showing at this year's Sci-Fi London, they're showing The Wizard of Oz, because that's in a new print at the moment that I believe is showing at BFI or maybe the Barbican, something like that.
At the moment?
Yeah, or soon.
Okay.
It was in this week's Time Out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, anyway, and 2010, the lesser-known sequel to 2001, possibly, if anything, to commemorate the death of Arthur C. Clarke, who died a couple of months ago. And then, in order to make the festival inclusive to all audience, there's a kids' film called Your Friendly Neighbourhood Hero, and I believe that Louis is running a competition for kids to make their own superhero costumes or short films and hand them in, and then there'll be some sort of presentation before that screening.
Yeah, the inclusion of kids in the festival I find kind of funny.
In what way?
But it's good, you know, good. But,
well, I mean, I went to EasterCon at Easter at a hotel near Heathrow, which is a sci-fi literary festival, and I talked to some of the people who did presentations there and some of the authors who were talking in panels, and they were saying that there's this sort of distinct identity between literary conventions and media conventions. Well, I think the good thing about Sci-Fi London is it's kind of straddling that divide. It's not trying to pigeonhole itself as, oh, we're the kind of festival that only celebrates literature, or we're the kind of festival that only celebrates film. And something I think that's missing, actually, from Sci-Fi London these days that they used to have when it was at the Curzon Soho is this thing called Talkie-Oki, where they had this circular table with sort of webcams, and people could just come and sit down and talk about the film that they'd just seen and engage in conversation with other people in the cinema in a way.
Yeah, that sounds great. Why have they given up on that?
I think it's just because the Apollo West End, well, it's a great venue in terms of location and seating and maybe not prices, that it's a bit of a bottleneck when it actually comes to getting to the screening rooms. There's no way that they could really fit it. But at least it's given the festival this prestige that it might not have had at other venues.
Well, what do you think of that new venue? It seems like a strange choice for Sci-Fi London, really.
Speaking as a Sci-Fi London employee, it wouldn't be my first choice. But I can see why they did it. I mean, the same way that the Fright Fest has moved out to the Prince Charles as well, that because horror and sci-fi is becoming more and more popular in the mainstream, they want to attract some of that crossover audience that perhaps might be limited to cinemas that have perhaps just like an art house, you know, sort of feeling to them.
Okay, but it's great, I think, that they try and attract more people. But at the same time, if it means that the selection of the films is going to be more mainstream and that the venue is a bit, well, is very mainstream, then maybe that's not something to be encouraged.
Well, perhaps this is something we can discuss in a year's time from now. You've been listening to I'm Ready for My Close-Up on Resonance 104.4. My guest has been Virginie Selavy, and there'll be another episode of I'm Ready for My Close-Up at the same time next week.